Did you know that the difference between a good cup of coffee and a great cup of coffee is starting with freshly roasted beans? And furthermore, did you know that most coffee you get at the store or a cafe could have been roasted months before it got to you, and there's no way to tell? Which is why it's time to switch to Spark Plug Coffee. Spark Plug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf. But the best part is that Spark Plug delivers this exceptional coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. And you will taste the difference. You can order Spark Plug as you need it, or use their autopilot set it and forget it delivery so that you'll never worry about running out of fresh coffee again. And right now, Spark Plug is offering a 10% discount to Top 100 listeners. If you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, that's all one word, the number 100, the offer applies to any size coffee order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So what are you waiting for? The time has never been better to start making the best coffee you've ever had in your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
What's up, movie kids, and grazie for letting the next 130 project drop into your lives today. We were the originators of podcasting about the American Film Institute's Top 100 lists. Well, the two main ones, the 1998 and 2007 ones. But we got through all those films 3 years ago. So now we hack away at various classics. And we spoil those classics. I'm the down-on-his-luck poster hanger who gives wine to children, Ryan Ellis. And here's the most dedicated cyclist I know, my wife, Bev.
That's me.
No one steals your bike. Ever?
Once, like 15 years ago, when I lent it to my roommate, and she left it unlocked in the backyard, and somebody snatched it.
Idiot. Snatched it. They said smashed it. That'd be even worse. It's unlocked, but I'm going to break it. I don't want it. I'm petty. Okay, the coming attractions trivia. For this week's picture, the classic Italian drama Bicycle Thieves, which was number one on the Sight and Sound pool the very first year they released that list in 1952. They did that every 10 years from that point on, 62, 72, and so on. Name the other three movies that have ranked number one on either the critics' or directors' poll in the decades since.
It's amazing to think that in all these years, only three movies between those two lists have topped the list, other than Bicycle Thieves. Tokyo Story?
Just recently.
Vertigo?
Also just recently.
But overwhelming dominator, Citizen Kane.
Yeah, Bicycle Thieves was number one that first year. Then it was Kane for decade after decade until the 2012 poll when it was Vertigo on, I forget now, the critics list?
I think it was the
Tokyo Story on the directors. One of those two, anyway, is the way that worked out. Kane's still way up there, but those two took over number one spots. And for a long time, it was just a list. It wasn't two separate lists, and it was always Citizen Kane for so long. All right, then, Ladri di Biciclette was an Italian production, so we'll shit-can any talk of AFI lists right now. It was released in Italy 70 years ago, in November 1948, then came out in America about a year later. Bev, you should probably remind people what this very old movie is about with the Bicycle Thieves skinny.
Lamberto Maggiorani is Antonio, a down-and-out father in post-war Italy, so desperate for a job that he pawns his family's dowry bedsheets to get his bike out of hock so he can go to work putting up posters in Rome. When Antonio's bike is stolen, he takes his son along on a day-long search of all the seedy parts of the city, pursuing the thief and his bike, and becoming increasingly desperate as the day goes along.
Or, in a nutshell, a U-lock, or even a decent length of rope, would have saved this dude a lot of trouble. I don't know if they had U-locks back then, but a rope. Just tie it up somewhere. Okay, so the Rotten Tomatoes numbers are extraordinarily strong in this movie. 98% of critics like this film. 56 fresh, only one rotten, and 94% of audiences. It's also 97th on the IMDb's 250. It flip-flops with 96th here and there, but it's around that point. So it's a post-war neorealist docudrama shot in the streets. What do you think of this film? Your first time seeing it as well, right?
I watched it in college, but when I say I watched it in college, I mean, I don't really remember it very well. I suspect that what probably happened is, like, a third into the film, my friend suggested that we cut class, and I took him up on his suggestion, because I remember the first third of the film, and the rest of it seemed pretty shiny and new to me. As a 19-year-old, I don't expect I had the patience and wisdom to appreciate this film for what it is. This film is really moving. Like, it is rare for me to watch a film this old and find myself this caught up. If we had had the chance to see it along with a lot of other films that came out in 1948, I think we would recognize it for just how progressive it is. Mm-hmm. So I really enjoyed it, but it's a downer.
It's very much a downer. Next week's movie is also going to be a downer.
Yeah.
Some of the great movies are, though. I'm a big fan of the film, too. I've seen it three or now four times, I guess. It's hard not to appreciate the documentary feel, but it's also a movie. It's not a documentary. They did shoot with a lot of cameras from different angles to get authentic acting from these amateur actors.
Unbelievable.
I don't know if anyone in the cast had experience, but certainly not the major players. You mentioned Lamberto Maggiarini, however you say his name, who plays Antonio, was a newcomer. The kid, Enzo Steola, was a newcomer. Liana Carell, the wife, a newcomer. They made a fair amount of movies. Well, then again, Maggiarini only made 16 in total. The kid made 15, and Carell made just 10, or she acted for 10 years, I should say. She actually got into writing scripts after doing this movie. Well, years later on, I suppose, after her acting career. We talked about the actors in depth, for instance, on Golden Pond last week. Two of the greats of all time, really three of the greats of all time. The two Fondas and Katharine Hepburn in On Golden Pond. But we don't know these actors, so there's really not much more we can say about them. But they're very good, especially for amateurs who never had done this before. Working with a director who'd been in the business for a little while, Vittorio De Sica, but it's not like he'd been around for 20 years himself and said, well, I can mold this kid and this grown man. He had to learn in a way, too.
So De Sica believed that everyone could play one role perfectly. They could play themselves. So when he cast, he was very interested in casting people who were already living the lives that he wanted to depict. He found Maggiarini. I'm sure we're both...
Maggiarini.
The gentleman who played Antonio. He wasn't a professional actor. He was a machinist in a factory. I think it was his kid was auditioning to play Bruno. And he saw him and he was like, no, no, he's what I want. And with Bruno, similar thing, that the child that they cast to play Bruno, he just saw that kid and encouraged him to audition. The story goes, according to an interview that I saw with the actor who played Bruno, Enzo...
Steola.
He said that De Sica saw him hanging around and then arranged to have the auditions take place where he lived so that he would be encouraged to audition. And he actually cast two kids and then did rehearsals with them for a few weeks before he settled and decided that he should get the part because he just thought he was a better actor. The other kid, he said, got a bike. He got fired, but they gave him a bike for his time. Mm. And he was mad because he didn't get a bike. But of course, these two total newcomers who have no experience acting, you talk about On Golden Pond, some of the best actors in the business in that film, but can you say any of their performances are better than these two actors in this
Probably
movie?
Not.
They break my heart. There's just so much truth and pathos and authenticity in their performances.
They work well together as father and son as well. There is that moment where Antonio hits Bruno, and that's when things are getting really grim. Then they have fun at lunch when Antonio gives him wine and they have a nice little meal. But then there's also that point where the kid is looking over another kid, really snobby looking little bastard, who's eating
pasta.
A better meal
but just like
with
pasta.
His family.
In Italy in that time, pizza was cheap. Pasta was what you ate when you had money. And Antonio says, you have to make millions.
Of lira,
yeah. Before you can afford to feed your family pasta.
Well, regardless of what that family's eating, this is probably a common occurrence for them. That's the feel I got. And for the Ricci family, this is not a common occurrence at all. Speaking of money, De Sica raised the money for this film independently. So he is an uncredited producer along with Giuseppe Amato, who was the actual producer. That guy went on to do La Dolce Vita, the very famous Italian film in the early 60s. It's one of those examples of where the money's on the screen. I don't know how much money he raised, but he didn't need to raise that much to make this movie because it was just shot in the streets. Now, maybe permits were tough to get back then. They are now, probably in every city, certainly in major cities. You have to do so many things to get location shooting to work out for you.
But they weren't shooting at the Colosseum, you know. They were shooting in the back corners of Rome.
The real parts of the city, and yeah. Of course, post-war, too. One of the big themes in the film is the guy wants a job. He wants his bike, but that's because he needs a job. He can't have the job he had, the poster hanger job, or other ones probably either, unless he has transportation. But what he and those other guys in the beginning of the film are doing are practically begging for shitty, low-paying jobs. Little changes over the course of history, does it? People groveling for jobs, basically, like we saw years ago when we did On the Waterfront, where those guys are begging for a physical job, a hard job, a backbreaking one, that in the course of that story does kill somebody. Now, it's also, I think, a setup in that movie, but the point is that that's a physical job that they are trying so hard to get, and who wants that? It's almost like being a coal miner, but you got to do something to make money.
You say the theme is about wanting a job. I would say the biggest theme of the film is dignity. The dignity of working for what you have. You never see them starving. They don't really look that lean.
That's in their future, I think, though.
Sure, but you feel that desperation, but it's not so much that they are lacking in food and what they want, it's that they are stripped of their dignity throughout the course of the film. First, there's this job offer that he has to lie to accept, and then the bare mattress. When I talk about seeing the first third of the film when I was, 19 years old, this scene that I couldn't forget was them violently stripping the sheets off the mattress, leaving it bare, and then selling them so that they could get their bike out of hock. And he's shamed by that moment of weakness when he decides to buy pizza for them for lunch and buy wine. He's like, we deserve this. We can have this. And then there's a moment where he realizes, this is stupid. We actually can't even have this. And he feels guilty for spending the money.
But those sheets are gone. They're not getting them back.
Yes. That lunch is going to cost him. Finally, his dignity is truly crumbled to nothing when he has to resort to stealing the bike at the end. He steals the bike, and he fails because they catch up with him.
Instantly.
But no! He gets across the plaza.
The guy sees him right away. What do you mean? He sees him instantly.
Okay, he sees him right away, but he's on a bike and he's on foot. Like you said, I'm an avid cyclist. Bikes are fast, man! It is very easy to outrun someone on a bike. They are chasing after him, and they catch him. It feels almost intentional, like he wants to be outrun by them, because how else could he not get away? They could have staged it, they could have blocked it, that he's getting away. Of course a bike is faster than people on foot, and then somebody hears them yell out and stops him because they already kind of have to jump on him. No, I thought they caught up with him.
This is a movie that has two different crowds shaming Antonio in the space of about 10 minutes, including the ones at the end. I thought that they surrounded him and stopped him from getting away.
They surround him, but they come from behind. He keeps getting shamed by crowds. Again, it's his dignity being stripped away. This is a man who is a good man. There's no doubt when you watch him throughout the course of the film, he just wants to do right. He's so happy when he gets that shitty job hanging up posters. He's so happy.
A country coming out of the war, which most countries were coming out of the war at that time frame in the mid to late 40s. But it's a job that doesn't mean anything. He's putting up posters. I'm not trying to slam that. He's making money, or he would have kept making money had the bike not been stolen. Work is work. But putting up posters, which is probably a very deliberate touch by De Sica. Let's give him an unimportant job. But he can't even keep that.
It's Rita Hayworth, right? These very glamorous Hollywood, the exuberance of wealth, and that's his job, is to plaster it all over Rome. The movie's illustrating that the true pain of poverty isn't necessarily the struggle for things to make ends meet. It's the depths to which you're forced to go so that you can survive, and then living with those choices. I think that's illustrated further when he finally encounters the thief near the end of the film. You talk about the two moms that encircle him. One of them is the mob trying to protect the man who, we're sure, that's the thief. That's the guy who stole his bike. He should be the villain of the film. But there's this weird moment there when he has a seizure, when all of his neighbors stick up for him.
Is he faking it?
Does it matter if he's faking it or not?
Because Antonio's not going to win that argument with that many people.
Whether it's about Antonio or not, I'm saying when I was watching it and I see him have a seizure, whether he's actually epileptic and he suffers from seizures, or he's actually so desperate that he had to steal a bike and now he has to fake that he has seizures and all of his neighbors stick up for him, he's Antonio. Maybe it's easier for him to sink to the gutter and steal from people to make it in this world, in this city, in this time and place. But I think it's because the neighbors stick up for him, and suddenly Antonio is turned into the villain, and you can completely see how they're both victims of the same system.
It's also easy to say, if you've only seen the movie one time, that may not be the guy. He could have the wrong guy in the first place.
It's the same actor.
I'm just saying, if you see it the first time, you don't know who these actors are, you could assume that he's just accusing the wrong person. This movie has a post-war paranoia because Antonio suspects everyone of ripping off his bike. This isn't a years-long quest like the Searchers, but it's a long enough quest where he thinks everyone is responsible for ripping him off. In the Old West, you get strung up for stealing a horse, or horses. In this case, now it's a bike. Now no one strings him up. But it's the same idea, which is, you take my transportation, you might as well have killed me. That's why horse wrestling was such a big deal back in the Old West, because somebody can't get around, and they're probably going to die.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
No mode of making a job or whatever, so that's why it was such a big deal. When Antonio's bike gets stolen in the beginning of the film, or near the beginning of the film, it's a really well-directed fake-out that the bike will be stolen before it really is.
Yeah, there's a scene where he just leaves it outside when they go up to visit the psychic, and you're like, this is the moment.
But it's not.
But that's the paranoia that you sit with for the rest of the film, because you know something terrible is going to happen to him. It's really suspenseful.
So instead, it gets ripped off when he's doing the job. Was he irresponsible not to keep a closer eye on the bike? Now, he was working, hence the rope I mentioned before. The guy's pretty ballsy, though. The one who steals the bike, he just takes it right there. They're on a pretty major street and just gets away. Maybe because he knows, I can ride faster than this guy can run. Plus, he's on the ladder. Antonio's got a ways to come down the ladder and then go after him.
He has a friend, too, who's helping him. Mm. The guy who's pretending to help Antonio get his bike back is actually that guy's buddy and intentionally keeping him away.
When Antonio does the same at the end, though, and steals someone else's bike, it's really drawn out. You mentioned tension. It's very Hitchcock-esque, in fact. The moment happens, but it's that whole bomb under the table thing that Hitchcock talked about. When it doesn't go off, that's suspense. I remember when I saw this movie the first time, I heard a lot about it. It was still called The Bicycle Thief back then. I don't know if it was the DVD release and that special edition that we have over there is when they actually changed the title. I think the actual old DVD, which probably looked like dog shit, was The Bicycle Thief. Now it's called what it should be, which is Bicycle Thieves. But anyway, when I saw the movie the first time and didn't know that much about it, I was saying out loud to myself, don't do it, don't steal it. That's the tension that plays out very well. I got involved. Not every movie makes you feel involved. Do the right thing towards the end. You want to get in the middle of that mob and just push everyone in. Stop! Don't kill each other! Please stop!
You know what's funny is in that moment in the film, as he's eyeing the bikes and Bruno is there and he's had this horrible, terrible, no good, very bad day, I'm saying, just take the bike! Actually, what I'm saying is, there's all those bikes there. There's the soccer game that's getting out, and there's all these people.
He waits too long, and then they all come out, and it's too late.
I know! It would have been so easy to just mingle with the crowd, blah, 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 and take any bike you want, and just ride away, la-di-da, I just saw the soccer game. That would have been a way easier way to get away with stealing a bike, but he chooses the solo bike. But at any rate, I'm the opposite, where I was rooting for him. Take the bike! It'll solve all your problems! You're so worried about him, and you just have so much pathos for him and his son.
I was too worried about him getting caught, which is of course what happens, and he doesn't go to jail, although that's where it looks like it's going. But because Bruno doesn't get on the streetcar, which is what Antonio tells him to do, he gets his own version of being guilted by a crowd, in a way, guilted out of it. The other guy says, oh, fine, he's got a kid, no big deal, no harm done in the end, I got the bike back. But Antonio probably does belong in jail, he did steal the bike. And he's only saved by Bruno's appearance.
It's like the final kick to his dignity there. Just to add insult to injury, his son, who he didn't want to see any of it, witnesses it all. And then winds up even being his savior when all those men take pity on him. It's because of Bruno saying, oh, father, father, holding his hand, being like, what's happening? Mm-hmm. Freaking out. That's why they take pity on him, because they see this little boy. And imagine what that would do to Antonio's already damaged pride. That man is broken by the end of the film. Mm-hmm. And there's the heartbreaking scene of him walking away. Him and Bruno are holding hands and Bruno just keeps looking up at him. That kid, how did they get this performance out of him? The love and concern, but also this naivete. He doesn't totally understand what's going on, but he's a blank slate who's soaking it all up and picking everything up. You really get the feeling that this day will loom large in Bruno's memory and perhaps color the direction of his life.
It's a strong performance. It's not ever cloying, I wouldn't say.
No.
I love that he's wearing shorts as well. They both wear the same outfit for most of the movie because it is set in that day. Kind of that North by Northwest thing in a way, where the guy's wearing the same suit the whole movie. And speaking of North by Northwest, Cary Grant, yes, Cary Grant, was bandied about to play Antonio, as was Henry Fonda. I could see Fonda. Cary Grant, I don't know. He played a Cockney or something like that earlier in the decade where he's supposed to be some down-on-his-luck, dirty dude in the street kind of thing. I don't remember that movie all that well. But Cary Grant was associated, even by this point, with class and grace and money and all that kind of thing. Henry Fonda, Okay, maybe more so. But then you get these amateur actors, and they're probably more effective than the bigger names would have been.
I just can't imagine how that could have ever happened. It's an Italian film, Italian language spoken, and also just De Sica, his whole aesthetic is very authentic, cast real people, shoot it in the slums of Rome.
Well, he was raising the money himself. Maybe the whole point was, if I can get a movie star, I can get more money.
Yeah,
but then when that wasn't happening, he got enough to make the movie and probably got less than he would have liked to have, but got enough to actually get it made. Enzo Steola, the kid, was in The Barefoot Contessa for Joe Mankiewicz in the, I think, 50s. I've seen that movie. I don't remember the details of it. I don't know if he spoke Italian. Maybe he learned English somewhere in there, but I'm assuming he didn't know English at this point, being that young in Italy after the war, where they were one of the bad guys, too. Lamberto Maggiorani, whatever his name is. He was uncredited in Umberto D, which is one of De Sica's future movies. De Sica made Shoeshine as well, which is a movie that I remember that Pauline Kael raved about. She loved that one an awful lot. But neither of them are in a lot of big-name titles, including Italian movies that I recognized, at least.
I read this interesting story about Maggiorani. He was a machinist. He worked in a factory. When he returned to his factory job after making the film was a big success. He didn't make a lot of money. He got paid $1,000, which would be the equivalent of like 10 grand today. It's not nothing, but it's certainly not enough to retire on. He returned to his job, and when there were cutbacks, they let him go because they were like, you're a movie star.
Mm-hmm.
You'll be fine. He wasn't. He acted a few more films, but he never repeated this success, and he struggled as a result of starring in this very successful film.
Reminds me of Slumdog Millionaire, where they said the kids were taken care of with education. But I'm not sure if they had a true future after that. The kids that play the youngest and then middle-aged, but anyway, whatever.
Middle school age.
Middle school age, that's what I should say. Versions of the main characters in that movie. They were at the Oscars, and you did hear stories about how they were taken care of with their schooling. But a lot of Hollywood movies, not that Slumdog was really a Hollywood movie, have probably not intentionally done that kind of thing, like this movie would have done, also not a Hollywood movie. But you have these people in this movie, and then at the end of it, you don't mean to necessarily, but it's kind of like, okay, bye, kick you to the curb. Speaking of the curb, there's a point where the two guys are sitting in the gutter. It feels like it's a vision of their future, where they're going to be homeless and living on the street with Maria, the wife.
Do you think at the end of the film that they're going to be okay?
No, yeah. Not at all. It's one of the reasons why I didn't want to steal that bike. I didn't think it was going to be a good scene. Because he's trying to find his bike using the serial number. The bike he stole, had he gotten away, also has a serial number. And he's probably like me. He would have felt like, I'm going to get caught. Other people might get away with this. I wouldn't get away with this long term.
But you talk about the serial number and getting away with it. The movie does illustrate that the cops are pretty useless. They really didn't help him. They were like, go find your own bike. Good luck. Haha.
We got him working his shift at the crime lab.
Yeah, exactly. We're all probably familiar with minor crimes. The cops just don't give a damn. But apparently, in post-war Italy, this was a real problem. There was rampant thievery. There was a total lack of civil order. Government had broken down. The police were useless. And authority was confused by all the various allied occupiers. So there was a real struggle, which, let's face it, Italy continues to have a pretty bad reputation for corruption. So I don't know if Italy as a country ever really recovered from this period of time where you can't trust the authorities.
Mussolini! Put your lot in with Hitler and you pay for it. So what's the better title? Bicycle Thief or Bicycle Thieves? There is the payoff that Antonio is going to steal eventually, too, with that title. But in some ways, the Bicycle Thief is more pithy.
I like Bicycle Thief better, and I know it's incorrect. I just like it because if the film is called Bicycle Thief, you think the title is about the guy who stole his bicycle, and then it has the twist at the end that he's the bicycle thief all along.
But Thieves is a spoiler.
Thieves is a bit of a spoiler. I just like that irony, that little twist at the end better, because then the true meaning of the title doesn't sink in until the ending.
So we want to be accurate, but I guess, prefer Bicycle Thief myself.
Oh, see, there you go. You agree with me. But the proper title is Bicycle Thieves.
That's why I will be hard on you or anyone else about that, but they had it right the first time. Ladri di biciclette is the Italian title. One thing that was really charming about this, by the way, is the actors doing the Italian hand gestures. They do it a lot. So even though we think it's a stereotype when you do that, oh, mamma mia kind of gesture, they do it plenty in this movie, so it must be a real Italian thing because it's Italians making this movie.
I had a good friend in college who was an Italian exchange student. And he legitimately did all those gestures all the time. It was adorable. He would actually do that thing where he curls fingers under his chin and then...
That bafangul!
He taught us all kinds of Italian swear words.
Clichés come from somewhere. So their director, Vittorio De Sica, I mentioned Shushan and Umberto D. He's actually got more acting credits in his resume than directing credits. His only ever Oscar nomination, and I'm including for directing, was for supporting actor in 1957's A Farewell to Arms. And his IMDb picture is a bit of a heartthrob. But he is a talented director. I've seen quite a few of his films, and this is probably the most famous and best one, but Umberto D is pretty good too. Sergio Leone of Spaghetti Western fame was an assistant on this picture as well. The writer was Cesare Zavattini. Well, six other people are credited as well, but he was the main writer. He had three Oscar nominations, so even though De Sica had none of the writing or directing variety, his writer had three in total, including for this movie.
And he was a member of the Italian Communist Party. Oh. He did a lot of research by going into the slums of Rome, hanging out in brothels, and hanging out with psychics. And, yeah.
It's based on Luigi Berlini's novel, which was released a few years earlier. Technically, the movie's 1:3:7:1, so you get the old square ratio. In the 40s, of course, you would have had that. It's a hell of a nice black and white print on the Criterion DVD.
It really looked amazing.
It's one of the best looking movies we've watched in a while, because we've seen a lot of mediocre ones. On Golden Pond was not anamorphic, so we had to blow it up, so it looked even worse than it would have. But this really stood out. It's one of the better looking movies we've seen in quite a while. The cinematographer, Carlo Monturi. I don't know all these names. I can't pronounce these names.
Our apologies.
He shot 154 movies in nearly 50 years, mostly Italian titles, of course. The editor was Eraldo De Doma, who cut Rome Open City, which is definitely a precursor to this, and that whole docudrama feel, which was shot a few years before. And Umberto D also cut that. And the music was Alessandro Cicognini, who did the music for Shushan and Umberto D. What did you think of the cinematography, the editing, and the music score?
Well, listen, this is considered one of the greatest films in history for a reason, and that is because all the components really work. It's not just good, it's great. Everything is wonderful. The cinematography is beautiful, but it had, like you say, the documentary feel. It has this starkness, it has this authenticity. The music, I didn't really notice. It was one of those just great scores thing that kind of blends in and just worked with real subtlety. And the editing, the pace, you cannot complain. It's like really beautiful how the story reveals itself.
Speaking of authenticity, Bruno, or the kid, Enzo, was nearly run over twice. That one scene where the cars nearly hit him, that was apparently pretty authentic. And it's because they didn't have the ability to shut down streets.
A lesser film would have shown us that all along, Bruno was the possession that was irreplaceable, more valuable than any bike. But that's only partly true for the very poor who can't care for their children when their life rests on this razor's edge between survival and destitution. So throughout the film, Antonio is ignoring Bruno. He's in traffic. At one point, he thinks he may have been the boy that drowned. A boy drowns and he's like, oh no, I haven't been looking out for my son. That could be him. And he's so distracted by his troubles that he continually ignores Bruno. And at the end, Bruno's almost the one comforting Antonio. But at no point do you get that catharsis that a lot of films would give you, where a father turns to his son and is like, we'll be okay because we have each other. The cold truth is, they won't necessarily be okay.
I don't think they're going to be. During lunch, you could argue that Antonio's doing that by trying to show the kid a good time. But that's
it. He loves Bruno. I never wonder if he loves his family and if he loves his son. They have like really wonderful rapport with one another. Ben Antonio is always distracted by this bigger concern of how he is going to get his bike back, because without his bike, he doesn't know how he's going to keep Bruno alive.
Needs his horse.
Yeah.
And incidentally, he slaps Bruno right before they go to lunch. So there's that contrast of violence and then doing a nice deed for him. Mm. And then, as you say, for most of the rest of the film, he's pretty neglectful. Right down to one of the last shots, it's Bruno that comes up to him and puts his hand in his father's hand. It's not the father being the father so much. It's the son being the father, being the caretaker.
My heart in that last scene.
Some of the best performances that year are in this movie. They weren't recognized. We'll talk about the Oscars in a second. But this was the year of Treasure of the Sierra Madre and Hamlet. Olivier won the Oscar for Best Actor. He was overdue, and he was very good in that film. Bogart wasn't even nominated for his performance in Sierra Madre, but these two could certainly have been, and maybe should have been, in the running for actor and supporting actor.
You know what's crazy is that this film, only once did it ever top the Sight and Sound list, and that was in 1952.
The first time.
But also 4 years after the film came out. Can you imagine? Mm-hmm. It would be like if somebody released a list of films this year And the number one film was 12 Years a Slave. Think of a movie that came out in the last 4 or 5 years.
That was 2013, so that's okay. 5 years ago.
Imagine that that outranked all the other great films. This film had to have made an enormous, unprecedented impression on critics and people who loved film. As much as we appreciate it for what it is now, and it is still a film you can really truly enjoy just on its own terms without thinking about history or film criticism and stuff like that, but we'll never appreciate how much it must have actually shaken up film and introduced innovations or just made people feel things that they hadn't felt before.
Feel the freedom to try to make a movie like this yourself, like Rome Open City had done before it. Let's go shoot in the streets. Sierra Madre, I mentioned, the same year as this. Couldn't have been influenced by it when it's the same year and it was Hollywood versus a small film in Italy. But they took that movie on location, which was not common at all back then. And then John Huston and Bogart did the same thing again 3 years later in The African Queen. The Third Man has got to be influenced by this movie to some degree. It came out about a year later. They shot these bomb-ravaged streets of Vienna. So they're over in Europe, not that far from where this movie's set, if you think about it.
Grittiness. They don't look gritty to our eyes. I think our sensitivities have been changed over the years, but that was what people wanted to see in post-war.
And not dwelling on the war that had just happened, but it's definitely a factor in both movies. The remnants of it, especially in The Third Man, where you see these pieces of rubble just laying there. It's not so prevalent in this movie, but the influence does remain. Also, black and white, all these movies we're mentioning, Sierra Madre, Third Man, and of course this one. This is also the movie that David Gahane goes to see in The Player the night that Griffin kills him. They call it The Bicycle Thief, but yeah, he goes to see this classic movie. So I'm assuming that Robert Altman is a big fan if he's going to put that in his movie. The film was nominated for only one Oscar, the screenplay, which it did not win, and it won an honorary Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film. I don't think that was a regular category back then. It's like documentary wasn't always a category at the Oscars. It took a while for that to become a common category, and the Foreign Language Oscar was, I should look it up, I don't remember exactly when, but it became a more common thing later on. We mentioned the Sight and Sound list, so it was first in 1952, then it was seventh in 62, which is still pretty good, sixth in 2002, and then 10th in the most recent one in 2012. So it's still on there despite all these years passing and so many movies that could have knocked it off. There's a great representation on the Sight and Sound list always. It's so international. When you look at the actual 100 or 50, whatever it is that they actually publish, there's plenty of American films and some of the obvious ones like The Godfather duo. Usually they're put together. Raging Bull is nearly always ranked that high. We mentioned Vertigo, of course, is. Citizen Kane still is. But then you get movies like Bicycle Thieves, Tokyo Story, and other foreign films that have been respected all these years and have not been forgotten by the critics or by the directors in those polls.
All that, and yet, you know who hated the film when it came out? Italian critics.
Oh, yeah?
Why? Yeah, well, because it was just an unflattering portrayal of Italy at the time. Italy that had already taken its lumps. By 1948, they were pretty down and out, and yeah. This kind of felt like a kick while you're down, showing the most unflattering image of Rome you could possibly show. And a lot of critics criticize it for that.
Roman Holiday, the famous movie with Audrey Hepburn and Gregory Peck, was 5 years later, and it's the opposite of this movie. It's also black and white, but the idea is let's show the grandeur of Rome and have this lovely romantic comedy with a unhappy ending, but still a happy ending in the end.
You wouldn't even know this film took place in Rome. All the things you associate with Rome, all the things tourists see when they visit the city, They do not make an appearance in this film at all.
I think they do focus on it in Roman Holiday, because that's part of the point.
Oh, of course. It's just a pretty Hollywood film that's there to delight us.
Okay, well, then last thoughts on our first foreign language film in quite a long time, and a great one, I would say, Bicycle Thieves.
It can kind of feel like homework to approach this film. It's like one of those films that you have to see if you care about movies. And I'm not going to lie, it felt like a downer to watch it, but I can't stop thinking about Antonio and Bruno, those two characters, their relationship with one another. It has made such an impact on me. I look forward to revisiting it. This film would really repay repeat viewings.
Would you recommend it to a film fan but not a film buff?
That's a good question.
I would say no, because so many people say they like movies. We've talked about this a little more recently. Where we say, would you recommend this to somebody you know? Because everybody says they like movies, but if they don't really truly like movies, they may not get this one. They won't want to read the subtitles. I don't like reading subtitles, and this movie's only 90 minutes, not even quite 90 minutes long.
Or they may get it, or they may just get stuck on the fact that it's a downer. You kind of have to be okay with a movie that's going to make you feel bad.
Well, we had a bad-feeling movie this week, and we'll cover another sad one in 7 days as we plant our feet deep in the snow and tackle the underrated Sam Raimi thriller, A Simple Plan. Great movie from 1998. That was a damn good year at the movies. And here in Toronto, it's been cold the last few days, so it seems appropriate to have watched this right around the time it got deadly cold. I suppose by the time we post this, it could have been nice for 4 or 5 days, but as we record, it's been very wintry. So the coming attractions trivia for A Simple Plan. Who murders more people? Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs, Norman Bates in Psycho, or Hank Mitchell, played by Bill Paxton, in A Simple Plan?
All right, so for the answer to that, please check out next week's podcast about A Simple Plan. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, you can check out our entire roster, which includes hundreds of movies, including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free, but perhaps in exchange for all this great content, you could give us a rating and a review. We really appreciate that. And if there is a film that we haven't covered yet that you would really love to hear us talk about, mention it in your review, and we will seriously consider it. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51, or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code TOP100PROJECT. That's one word, TOP100PROJECT, and it is not case-sensitive.
Okay, wave the hand around. Mamma mia, don't steal that bike!
Ah, va fagora!
Ba-ba! They do that in the movie, so can we. We're just fitting in.
And cut.